Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. We have a sensational show for you today, listeners. So don't touch that dial other than to raise high the volume. So joining me are Bill Black to discuss the Tea Party's role in the laughable debacle of democracy that is called, technically, in political science or government 100 courses, US politics. Then Gerald Epstein will discuss the real issues that governments should be focused on. And that's followed by Margaret Gray, who will be here to talk about labour in the food industry and why we need to think about it, even as we think about consumerist and environmental questions. And rounding out the hour is Ben Carrington, here to clarify the hype over mega sporting events and discuss sports' contemporary racial dynamics. I'm joined now by William K. Black, former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan, or S&L, disasters of the 1980s. From 2005 to 2007, he was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention. And currently, Professor Black teaches economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, and since I used to work for a bank, I have to buy this title myself. His latest article is The Tea Party's Tactical Brilliance and Strategic Incompetence. Welcome, Bill Black. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you very much for having me.
And in terms of the Tea Party's tactical brilliance and strategic incompetence, where do we stand today, just really a couple of days after the madness, in a sense, subsided?
Well, with a further confirmation that both things were true. Now, the tactical brilliance I'm talking about was in manipulating the Republican members of Congress. The Tea Party is a minority of those folks, but they made it politically impossible for the majority of the GOP to oppose their position on how to play this game about holding the U.S. economy hostage. And while it was they were brilliant in manipulating Republicans, they were a complete failure at manipulating Democrats. And that was predictable given the way they played it. So I say it's strategic incompetence.
But at the same time, there's a populist element here that's remarkable, isn't it? I mean, if you and I go back many, many years to the 60s and the 70s, we think of the politics of spectacle as being something to do with the left, civil rights issues, women's issues, queer issues, so on and so forth, migrant questions. Now it seems as though the right has seized that terrain, that at the level of spectacle, getting people out and having a direct impact on capital P politics, Tea Partiers, birthers, and all these other people are remarkably effective, aren't they?
They're remarkably effective in some realms. It's an odd thing. So we actually have good demographic information now on the Tea Party. And in reality, the Tea Party is almost entirely simply the base of the Republican Party. And indeed, since many of them are older Americans, they were actually at one point part of the base of the Democratic Party. When they were nominally Democrats in the South, but were still deeply conservative and still very skeptical of minorities and such. So in some sense, they're extremely unlike the left that you're talking about, which was always more of the fringe of the party, as certainly as perceived by the party. These are the rank and file, but the rank and file who will actually show up for a caucus and will stay all day for a caucus. And increasingly, the Republicans pick their candidates through caucus or caucus-like events. And that means that literally a few thousand people end up selecting the candidate, and that brings you, of course, to intensity. And what you're certainly correct is that the Tea Party brings intensity, and it brings a degree of organization. And you're right, this too has antecedents in the civil rights movement, where the churches, the black churches in particular, were so heavily involved. Well, now it's evangelical churches that will get together entire busloads of parishioners who will go to a caucus, stay there all day, and vote for a particular candidate who has the most extreme views.
Well, Bill Black, thinking about this question of the immediate and medium-term future, it sounds as though, however strategically odd the Tea Partiers may be, they are very good at organising and they're grown-ups when it comes to sticking around and getting the votes you need. But where do they go from here? Is this their death knell? Or is it like when Barry Goldwater lost the election so spectacularly in 1964, the beginning of a rebirth for a new right?
Neither, I think. It is certainly not a death knell. And people who are saying that, I think, don't understand the Tea Party at all. And indeed, it comes back to what I just said. This is not a fringe group. This is actually a core group of the Republican Party that's been with the Republicans for over two decades. And so they're going to remain because, A, they don't want to actually form a new party, and B, they control
right.
substantial elements of the existing party, so they're not going to be pushed out. Now, it was strategically poor decision for the Tea Party itself. In other words, the Tea Party is weaker as a result of all of this in many ways. It is, of course, more unpopular than virtually any group in America. And it now has raised the hackles of a bunch of more sort of business-oriented conservatives. But this was nothing about the Tea Party, because in some sense there is no elected leader of the Tea Party. So there are two groups vying for control of the Tea Party. One, of course, is the Koch brother types who created and funded them, but don't necessarily always control them on a day-to-day basis. And the second is their own authentic leaders like Ted Cruz. So this crisis was far more about Ted Cruz than about the Tea Party. In other words, even though it was going to hurt the Tea Party, hurt the GOP, and hurt the United States of America, this was going to do great things for Ted Cruz, and it has. There are new, you know, stories in the big media about how Ted Cruz is now much more popular in Texas than before. And the theory, of course, is, hey, he said he was going to go to Washington and not be one of those, you know, regular Congress people, that he was going to fight the good fight and stay pure. And by God, he actually lived up to his word.
And Bill Black, in terms of the future, I guess some of the assumptions that are running around are that Tea Party-backed Congress people are pretty safe because they're generally in gerrymandered areas after the electoral redistricting of 2010, but that Republicans seeking to stand often for statewide office as per the Senate or as governors or as presidential candidates are now quaking in their boots because of the unpopularity of this extreme position. What do you make of that take?
There are aspects of that have truth. But remember, the Tea Party doesn't operate simply in safe districts. It operates very heavily in districts all through the Republican Party at this point. And so they are the Tea Party is already responsible for the fact that the Democrats continue to have a majority in the Senate. Because, for example, where I am in Missouri, our Democratic senator would clearly have been defeated by sort of the average Republican candidate. Instead, we had Scott Aiken of the, you know, legitimate rape infamy.
Right.
So the Tea Party has actually cost already in these major elections a significant number of senators, and actually enough that the Republicans failed to gain control and indeed lost seats. And indeed, they lost seats in the House, and that's despite immense gerrymandering where the Republicans actually get roughly 1.5 million fewer voters for Congress, for the House, than do Democrats. So they're actually, the Tea Party is very successful at statewide races in general, which is why you have seen this enormous effort in a whole series of areas, but particularly voter suppression, anti-immigrant, and, of course, anything to do with not only abortion but birth control. or women's rights in general. And you are correct that they looking down the road, I mentioned Texas, for example. Well, the nightmare scenario for the Republican Party is that within 10 years, they could lose control of Texas because of demographics.
Bill Black, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with William K. Black, former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. From 2005 to 2007, he was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention. Currently, Professor Black teaches economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, his latest article is The Tea Party's Tactical Brilliance and Strategic Incompetence. Joining us now is Gerald Epstein, Professor of Economics and founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the author of numerous books, including Radical Economic Perspectives on Globalization. Welcome to the program, Gerald Epstein.
Thanks for having me.
And I should say, I'm a huge fan of PERI, Political Economy Research Institute. I use a lot of its work.
Oh, great.
And so really thrilled that you can be with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
What we're hoping you can help us out with here, we've been doing quite a lot of work over the last few days, over the last few weeks on this program with Ian Masters, its principal host, me just sitting in. We've been trying to understand what's been going on with the attempts to destabilize U.S. politics, economics, and society in Congress as the debacle has unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you could help us out by taking a slightly longer view, political economic, to say what are the issues that the government, the Congress, and those of us who care about these things should really be focused on, not how do we get so many votes or what's the future of Republicans in the House of Representatives, but what are the big issues the federal government needs to tackle right now?
Great questions. And well, it seems to me that we're at an important juncture, and we have a short-term problem and a long-term problem. The short-term problem is we're still mired in the worst financial and economic crisis since the Great Depression. And what that means is that the private capitalist economy has failed. It has created this crisis and isn't able on its own to get us out of it. So the government really has to step in and play a bigger role than it has, both in this country and elsewhere. But there's also a longer-term conjunctural problem, which is how are we going to prepare ourselves to deal with global warming, with climate change? And in some ways, the solution to both of those problems is the same. It's weaning ourselves off of fossil fuels, making longer-term investments in green energy and create green employment that can help both the short run of generating more employment and the long run of making this transition. And I think a lot of the opposition that we're facing, it comes from those who oppose this solution to this problem. A lot of it is coming, in fact, from the fossil fuels industry and their supporters.
A really big event that happened this week here in L.A., Gerald, you may or may not be aware of, is that the Los Angeles Times became, I think, the first of the major bourgeois media in this country to say that actually equal time for climate change denial won't happen because it's nonsense and it's not scientific, and the idea that you must give multiple perspectives on a story doesn't include their lies. But it is interesting, isn't it, just how successfully that denial has taken hold.
That's right, and I think that's a very good step forward. I'm glad to hear about that. I didn't know about it. Yes, and among the big billionaires, as you know, who are funding this is the Koch brothers and other fossil fuel billionaires and magnates. And I think this fight that we just have been going through this past month and a couple years ago really is an attempt by these kinds of fossil fuel magnates to really prevent the government from moving forward. I mean, what we're losing out is not just the day-by-day policies, the day-by-day government help with in the economy and so forth, but what we're losing is this movement forward to get rid of our dependence on fossil fuels, and indeed we're moving in the wrong direction. If you look at a lot of the growth happening in our economy now, it's in developing new fossil fuels, fracking, and so forth. And I think that's just fine from the perspective of the Koch brothers and people of their ilk. And I think in some ways, there are a lot of people out there who are angry because they've lost their jobs, they've lost their livelihoods, and they're grasping at straws, and the people like the Koch brothers are manipulating them into anger about Obamacare and other relatively unimportant kinds of policies.
So on this question of the environment, which I'd like to hone in on for a moment, what you're suggesting is that the Koch brothers and others are not just ideologically driven. This is in part about a fantasy of science, but more importantly, it's about their own bottom line.
I think so. I think what they want to do is tie the government's hands because they know that history is moving towards the need for our, not only our country, but the whole world to deal with this existential problem, climate change. And they know that history is running against them and that it's only governments that can really make the dramatic changes that are necessary, either through a carbon tax or other kinds of regulations. And so their attempt, I think, is to simply tie up the government with all kinds of maneuvers, a bait and switch, shut the government down, threaten government default. The less government can do, the more government dysfunction, the better. And I think they understand that to protect the billions and probably trillions of dollars that are in the ground that they owe. Think about it. If we put on a carbon tax or we have other regulations to get our economy and the world economy more and more off of fossil fuels, then all of those assets that they own are going to be dramatically devalued, and that's what they want to prevent.
I'm speaking with Gerald Epstein, Professor of Economics and founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. He's the author of numerous books, including Radical Economic Perspectives on Globalization. Professor Epstein, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the employment consequences of greening the economy. You mentioned earlier that one of the ways in which the far right in the United States appeals to people is through economic insecurity. Frequently, we're told that environmentalism is a middle-class fad or interest that can't be afforded by the working class and that it threatens to further disrupt the agricultural and manufacturing base that used to characterize our economy. How would you answer that?
Well, I think that's wrong. As my colleague Robert Pullen at Perry, which you kindly said you read a lot of our material, my colleague Robert Pullen and a number of his co-authors have shown that investment in various kinds of green energy, wind energy, solar energy, other kinds of green energy, generates more employment per $100 or $1 million of investment than do investments in fossil fuels or investments in the military or investments in lots of other economic activities that the people on the right seem to prefer. So, in fact, moving towards a green economy by making those investments will actually generate a lot of jobs. And many of these jobs are good jobs. Some of these are entry-level jobs. And this will help to get not only the economy going and make this transition, but also will generate a lot of income and employment for working-class people and middle-class people and others. Now, of course, there will be some areas of the country that will be hurt by this, and particularly if you're thinking about coal country in Appalachia and elsewhere, they will, in the short run, economically, be hurt by this kind of transition. And so society has to make some kinds of adjustments to help them get through this and get out the other side. But that's, I think, a necessary but small price to pay for this transition that will be good for us in the short run and the long run.
Structural adjustment can sometimes mean something done by the left and not just by the right. That would be nice to see, wouldn't it?
Yes, and so I'm happy to see that there is so much movement on the left and among progressives to try to, for example, block the Keystone XL pipeline, smaller kinds of activities, cooperative, worker-controlled firms and communities that are trying to be much greener, and trying to push the government to make these kinds of changes. But unless we have a concerted effort from more in the Democratic Party, who increasingly are seeing for example, fracking and seeing natural gas as a bridge to a new economy, that's going to go nowhere. Natural gas is a bridge to an environmental disaster, and I'm really worried that the Democratic Party, unless they're pushed from the left, are going to start going more in that direction.
Gerald Epstein, I wanted to ask you about one other thing. We've got about a minute and a half left, and that is a second aspect of the current crisis, which is surely financial regulation, whether that's about how we regulate the banks or whether it's about what we do with various kinds of debt. Is there any prospect of adequate regulation of these profiteers?
Well, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that we've learned a tremendous amount about the nature of all the problems in the financial sector and what to do about it, how we can improve it, as a result of the crisis and as a result of a lot of people working very hard to try to figure this out and do something about it. The progressive groups associated, for example, with the Americans for Financial Reform, groups like Better Markets and so forth, have really learned a lot these last 5 years. And have put a lot of proposals on the table, including how to improve upon Dodd-Frank, how to break up the big banks, and Sherrod Brown and other legislators, Elizabeth Warren, have put forward a lot of good ideas. The problem, of course, is the power of money. And unless we can do something about Citizens United and the ability of financial firms and others to buy the government regulation or lack of regulation that they want, unless we can stop that, I'm afraid there really is no way that we're going to get this financial system under control. And one of these days, and who knows when, we're likely to see a repeat of the financial crisis. We would have seen it if the government had defaulted. We would have made Lehman Brothers look like a cakewalk. We dodged that bullet temporarily, but who knows if that'll come around in 2 months or so.
Gerald Epstein, thank you so much for joining us and leavening the despair with the hope.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Gerald Epstein, Professor of Economics and founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. He's the author of numerous books, including Radical Economic Perspectives on Globalization. We're going to take a break for station identification, and we'll be back to discuss questions of farm labor with Margaret Gray.
Outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, bedding, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding out.